FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and it is August 7th, 2017. The market continues its unbelievable, undescribable, unparalleled advance. Is this a good thing? Well, the millennials, last week, John and I discussed how they were getting into recreational vehicles big time. Now it turns out they are getting into stocks. Is this the ultimate contrarian indicator? Sell anything with wheels and anything that is traded on an exchange, perhaps. But in the meantime, email us at kl@kerrylutz.com. And John, good morning.
Morning, Kerry. Yeah, this is actually kind of a sad story because, as you said, last week we talked about how millennials, for various reasons, were big buyers of RVs, which are, you know, basically that's the big toy that you buy at the end of the cycle, right before everything falls apart. And then you have to sell it a couple of years into the resulting recession. And so we have, it sounds like, suckered the millennial generation into doing this kind of financial speculation, which won't end well for them. But, you know, it's also a sign that they can't afford to buy houses, so they have to live in trailers. But now Charles Schwab, the big discount broker, came out and said that new accounts formation is soaring. In other words, people are opening new brokerage accounts at a record pace. And most of those people are millennials, which means that, and they're buying stocks with those new accounts, which means that we baby boomers have finally suckered the millennials completely into the latest financial bubble that we've been blowing up. You know, they've been standing back for various reasons, mostly because they didn't have the money, I think, to speculate financially for years now. And it's been a question among economists and market watchers, you know, why the millennials weren't participating in the financialization of the economy. Well, it looks like they finally are. And they're doing it at a time when asset prices are as high as they've, well, higher than they've ever been in just nominal terms, and as high as they've ever been in relative to earnings, et cetera, terms. In other words, valuation measures are also approaching the levels of the 2000 tech bubble. So, and these guys are getting in right at that point. So it's, you know, it's sad. The baby boomers have screwed up the world on so many different levels. And now we're sucking in the generation of our kids and grandkids. And probably at a bad time. You know, most of the valuation levels that you see out there are shocking. I'll just mention one. And this is from John Hussman of the Hussman Funds. But the median price over revenue of the S&P 500. In other words, the stock price relative to the top line, what the company is bringing in day after day, peaked at a little less than 2% in the last cycle. In other words, in 2006 or so. Now it's at 2.5 times. It's never been that high before. And revenue is a much clearer indication of how a company's doing than earnings, because you can manipulate earnings, but it's hard to manipulate revenues. So price over revenue is a pretty good indicator of where we are in the stock market cycle. And this one at least is flashing sell big time. So, yeah. And so the question becomes, is this time different? Because that's what everyone always says at the peak of a cycle. They find reasons that it should continue that weren't there in all the numerous other times when it didn't continue past these extreme valuation levels. And the answer now to that question in a lot of people's minds is that, yes, it is different because we've never had central banks out there pumping this much liquidity into the system and promising to pump more in if need be. You know, you got the European Central Bank saying that it stands ready to react to squiggles in the market. You know, if it looks like the financial markets are starting to buckle under all the debt that's been taken on, they're willing and able and ready to pump that much more debt into the system to support the financial markets. And that's huge. That's never happened before because central banks are so powerful from a financial standpoint. They have an unlimited printing press. They can create as much new currency as they want with a mouse click. So if 10 trillion euros turn out to be what it takes to keep the European and by implication the global financial system chugging right along, well, the European Central Bank will supply it. And the Fed has shown that it's willing to do the same thing, although it's talking a different game right now. But let the stock market start to roll over and show signs that a stock market crash might metastasize into a depression, they'll be right back with money. So the markets are looking beyond the valley. In other words, if a correction comes, they assume that the government's going to meet it with massive amounts of new currency. So go ahead and buy the dips because the central bank has your back. And there's another factor here that I think we need to mention Martin Armstrong. Absolutely. Because he's been right with some what seemed like outlandish predictions over the last decade or
his
so.
His timing hasn't been perfect, but overall, his actual prophecy prediction forecast for the market has been pretty spot on. When I first started interviewing him years ago, he said the market was going to continue going higher and higher. And this was in large measure, it was the only game in town to put your money because people just lost confidence and trust in government bonds, in sovereign debt. And, like 3 years ago or 4 years ago, he said Dow 32,000. And at that time, the Dow was 16,000. And he thought it was going to be happening a bit faster. But he was among the only people who said this, John. So I'll cut him some slack. I mean, the markets now, it went up 6,000 points when everyone thought it was overvalued at 16,000, John. It could keep going on and on until it doesn't anymore.
Yeah, well, his take on the next few years is that we'll have a sovereign bond crisis. In other words, government bonds around the world are going to fall in price, rise in yield, and that's going to terrify a lot of money out of these immense markets. The bond markets are huge. They're bigger than the stock markets, bigger than any market around the world. And that money has to go somewhere, and it's going to see U.S. equities as the least dangerous place in the world, so that a tsunami of global cash will flow into U.S. stocks and give us another doubling from here, more or less. And that's based on valuation, crazy. But based on the fact that we've created a very different world out there where crazy stuff is the norm, you can't dismiss it. You can't just look at price to cash flow or something like that and say we're totally at the end of the road, because you've got all this currency, all this credit that was created in the past couple of decades out there having to go somewhere. Some of it will just be wiped out in a bond crisis, but a lot of it will be pulled out of the bond markets and will be sitting there in cash looking for a home. So I think this is great for gold and silver, by the way, too. The same factor that might push up the U.S. stock market would send gold and silver through the roof, because those markets are tiny. It would only, 1% of the global bond market flowing into silver.
Yeah.
That would be Bitcoin or Ethereum times 3 or 4, probably. Yeah. Hey, so.
And who has the largest position in silver right now, in physical silver?
JP Morgan Chase.
Yeah, how many ounces? 600 million that we know about?
Yeah, that's a weird, weird story, because they've been blamed for pushing down the price of silver via the paper market all these years. They're the main manipulator who comes in at weird hours with big short positions and smacks the market down and has pushed it far below its intrinsic value. In other words, where it should be trading based on its monetary and industrial value. And in the process, they've accumulated a lot of physical ounces, just an immense amount of physical ounces. Mm-hmm. So what are they doing that for? Are they going to switch gears and manipulate the market up from here? That's another factor besides fundamentals. Just fundamentals say that something like silver should go way up, given all the crazy stuff that's going on out there. But now you've got this giant player in there that appears to have an incentive to push the market up, or at least sit back and not manipulate it down and just let fundamentals play out from here. So I don't know. I don't know what it means exactly, but a long position on the part of somebody with market moving power tends to be bullish for that market. And now you've got the biggest whale in that sea, who appears to be in a bullish position right now. So we'll see. But I think that's one more reason why silver and to a lesser extent gold ought to just rocket from here. You know, you've got all these temporary cycles going on too, with like the commitment of traders report, which went very bullish a couple of months ago and is now kind of back to neutral. But we saw a nice pickup in gold prices once the commitment of traders report was very bullish. And so we'll see what happens going forward. And there's seasonality, which is very favorable right now. So all things considered, it's probably a good time based on history to be adding to your precious metal stack. But at some point in the not too distant future, it might be a phenomenal time, or it might be too late. You know, if this really starts to move, then good luck trying to buy, you know, 100 ounces of silver and have it delivered to your house. We'll be back in the situation of 2008, 2009, where you could go ahead and order it and you can send your money to the online dealer, but you might have to wait 6 months or 3 months, or I'm sorry, 6 weeks or 3 months before you actually get your delivery. So in the meantime, you're kind of in limbo. You don't want that to happen if you can help it. So it's still a good time, in other words, to be dollar cost averaging into precious metals. Buy a little bit each month and let your stack grow. And don't worry about the squiggles, but know that you want to be fully in to that segment of the market before the discontinuity happens. And we can't know when that's going to happen. That's the tricky thing about this. We don't know if the bond market crisis that so many people are predicting happens, which then distorts the stock market and gold and silver, or when JP Morgan Chase decides they want to be long and decides they want to get it over with right away and causes the price to quadruple of silver. You know, you just don't know when those things are going to happen, but they could happen very quickly when they do happen. So it's not a good time to be selling probably, and it's not a great time to be just sitting on the sidelines waiting to get in at that perfect entry point. You know, dollar cost averaging is so much wiser of a strategy because it doesn't force you to have some kind of knowledge of what's going to happen in this world, which you can't possibly have. You know, nobody can know how crazy things are going to get and when the real craziness is going to start, because we've created the conditions, as Jim Rickards says, for an avalanche. You know, lots of snow has fallen on the side of that mountain, and you can't know which snowflake is going to be the one to set off the avalanche or when that snowflake is going to fall, but we've created the conditions in which it's going to happen eventually. So it's a tricky world out there. Or certainly for professional money managers, because you kind of sort of have to ride this equities train, but you know the train is going to derail at some point. Mm-hmm. And so it must be very hard to sleep at night if you're running a fully invested 100% long equity fund.
I can't even imagine.
That's a tough job right now.
Can't imagine what it would be like, John, but it's got to be a frightening endeavor, to say the least. And there's just so many unsustainable economic trends, John, that something has to give. I mean, look, California, they just said LA County spent $1.3 billion on welfare for illegal aliens in 2015 and 16. And the state as a whole, the last figures they have, 2013, the state of California spent $25 billion. Now, I'm not sure how that's going to benefit the California economy. It's great to be an illegal. It used to be great to be the king. Now it's great to be an illegal. But you can't run countries, states, municipalities, counties with unsound, unsustainable programs and expect to have a good outcome. It just can't be done, John. I mean, what are these people thinking? What are they doing here is what I'd like to know, because this is total madness.
Well, it's also a very predictable part of the world that we've created, though, because we've been borrowing more and more money year after year for 30, 40, 50 years, and it's starting to bite around the world. At the same time, populations have been soaring. So you get huge increases in population in parts of the world where there wasn't enough food to go around to begin with. You know, you can't feed your family in big parts of Africa and Asia and Latin America right now. And you've got travel networks that are really unstoppable. You know, we cannot plug our borders. We can try, but it's incredibly logistically difficult. And Europe is figuring out how virtually impossible it is to stop the flow of people from mostly the Middle East and Africa, who can't survive where they are. So they're willing to risk their lives to go to Italy or Greece or wherever. Mm. And they're pouring in. So this is a scary extra problem, you know, that's on top of the debt that we've taken on, which by itself would be politically, economically, and geopolitically destabilizing around the world. You know, we've got a giant financial crisis coming, but at the same time, we've got a geopolitical and an immigration and a climatic problem coming too, where we're using up, you know, leaving aside the whole global warming thing, we're using up all the water that's available in big parts of the country or of the world. You know, parts of India, for instance, they've been digging wells to pull water out of the ground to use just to survive. And the level of water is dropping, so they constantly have to drill deeper and deeper and deeper. And they're basically running out of water. And this isn't, you know, a few thousand people. This is half a billion people who are in that situation just in India alone. And then add in Africa and chunks of Latin America where they just used up the water. And in the U.S., you know, where we're siphoning off all of our aquifers and it's not clear what we do next. So either desalination technology comes along that's cheap enough to satisfy everybody's water needs, or you've got one more reason why people are just going to leave their country and try to find someplace else to live.
Yeah.
And it's destabilized the places that are still stable because you can't have an influx of, you know, a 40% population increase in the space of a decade from cultures that aren't liberal democracies, you know, and that's what Europe is finding out right now. It's on the verge of a civil war, it sounds like, in a lot of places. And that's just beginning. It's not going to end. And at the same time, this is all happening. We've got North Korea developing nuclear weapons and missiles that can maybe reach the U.S. and Russia and China and the U.S. all butting heads in various places. And China kind of sort of picking fights with its neighbors in the South China Sea and the Middle East in flames. You know, this is a crazy world. Mm. And it's not going to get any less crazy anytime soon because of the mistakes we made in the past, which haven't completely yet come back to bite us. You know, just the finance thing. If the rest of the world was placid and ecologically stable and everything, and populations hadn't exceeded the carrying capacity of a lot of different countries, we would still have a financial crisis ahead of us just because we borrowed so much money. Yeah. But throw in all this other stuff, Kerry, and it does kind of make you want to just get that cabin up in the hills, go off grid.
You're becoming a prepper, John. Are you becoming a prepper now?
I'll tell you what, if I was living in downtown Los Angeles, I would totally be a prepper because the big systems that supply you are not necessarily going to keep working in the future for various reasons. But I'm out in Idaho where we're surrounded by food, so I don't really feel the need to stockpile anything. But I tell you what, if for people living in metropolitan areas, and, you know, big parts of Florida are like that, Kerry, because where you are, it takes a lot of big systems to make it habitable. You know, Florida was not a habitable place before the advent of widespread electricity and air conditioning. You know, take that away, even for a little while. And that's okay. That leads us to cyber war, where it's now possible to shut down electricity grids, power grids, as part of a conflict with another country. You don't have to bomb them. You just get into the utility network and shut it down. And then big parts of the country don't work anymore. And,
Instantly they stop.
Oh, instantly.
Right. I mean, like,
yeah. And then the EMP thing. God, Kerry, when you start going into this stuff, it just it goes on and on, doesn't it? You know, where somebody could set off a nuclear weapon in the atmosphere and just shut down all the electronics. And we're not in a position to function because we have way too many people to go back to, you know, the 1850s agricultural society that we once were, you know? Yeah. So
I don't want to be a farmer.
I don't have an answer for any of this.
I went to college so I didn't have to be a farmer, you know?
Yeah.
I don't have any desire to become a farmer now. I don't know about you, but no, thank you.
I had a garden for a while.
I mean, that's all well and good.
You know, nature wants to take back over. Yeah. And nature never gives up. It just keeps generating weeds mm-hmm. and bugs and things like that. Farming is hard.
Yeah.
You got to admire people who can do it well.
I do. But don't get me wrong. I'm not.
Most people want them to do that and then just send them the food. You know, you don't want to do it yourself.
Yeah. I'm not putting them down by any stretch. And I don't want you to think I am. It's just what I've chosen not to do. That's why I went to college. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thought that, that this could happen isn't very reassuring, to say the least, right? I mean, it's a little bit frightening, but I don't think it'll come to that. But, you know, we're dealing with complex systems. And Rickard says when you have a complex system, then a very minor issue can bring it down, even if it's not terrorism or something else, like what we saw happen with a number of years ago when we had a major blackout throughout the eastern part of the U.S. I mean, it was major and it lasted for like close to a day, longer in other parts. And, you know, we just are not prepared to deal with that by any stretch. Having a generator in your house ain't going to do it. You know, it just isn't going to do it. And this is the issues that we're confronting here, John.
Yeah. It is amazing when you look at the number of things that could go wrong right now mm-hmm. and the limited ability that we have to deal with more than one of them happening at once. You know, if there's a financial crisis and everything else is fine, then we'll just create a whole bunch of new currency and we'll have a big devaluation and maybe we get through it with mm-hmm. a tough decade. You know, but add in all the other stuff and you've got the real potential for something that's a lot more serious than, for instance, what happened in the 1970s when we had a burst of inflation and that limited the amount of debt in real terms because debt became less onerous as the dollar became less valuable. And then, you know, we entered the 1980s in pretty good shape and we went back to quote unquote normal. You know, that it's hard to see that happening again because the numbers are so much bigger. You know, we're in so much worse shape financially than we were in the 1970s. We were actually in pretty good shape in the 1970s, which gave us the firepower to get through a tumultuous financial period. We don't have anything like that now. Just the derivatives market alone is so immense that trouble there would be enough by itself to crash the global financial system. But the trouble wouldn't be just there when it comes, you know, it would be government bonds and equities and real estate and geopolitics and possibly the environment, you know, all of this stuff at once.
I think we'll leave it at that, John. Yeah. Even enough horrors for people to think about. If you're thinking about this, it's important to you, then you want to go over and take a look at John's site, which is dollarcollapse.com. And take a look at our site, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Sign up for both our newsletters. The Twitter feed is at Kerry Lutz. Email us at kl@kerrylutz.com. Facebook page is Financial Survival Network. And John, we will catch up with you again, same time, same place next week.
Great. See you, Kerry.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.